On Friday, October 18th, the Norris Group proudly presents its 6th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts joins Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. Proceeds for the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. This event would not be possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: Property Radar and Sean O'Toole, Housing Wire, the Apartment Owners Association, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, and President Bill Tan. Investors Workshops and Sean Watkins, Angel Bronzegeest, and Sarah Benora. Invest Club for Women and Iris Veneration and Bobby Alexander. San Jose Real Estate Investors Association and Geraldine Barry. MVT Productions. Wilson Investment Properties. Rhoda Construction. And White House Catering. For event information and tickets, visit isurvivedrealestate.com.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Christopher Thornburg. Christopher Thornburg is founding partner of Beacon Economics, LLC, and widely recognized to be one of California's leading economists, an expert in economic forecasting, regional economics, employment and labor markets, economic policy, and industry and real estate analysis. He was one of the earliest and most accurate predictors of the subprime mortgage crash that began in 2007 and of the global economic recession that followed. Since 2006, Dr. Thornburg has served on the advisory board of Wall Street hedge fund Paulson & Company. And between 2008 and 12, he was the chief economic advisor to California State Comptroller's Office and served as chair of State Comptroller Don Chang's Council of Economic Advisors. Whew. That's a long introduction because you're up to a lot. Christopher, welcome back.
Always good to be here, Bruce.
And I'll be in the audience for your October 29th, kind of letting us know what's going on in the Inland Empire. So let's talk just a minute about that. That last year, where were we, and have we made some progress, I guess?
The answer is last year we saw solid signs of recovery. The Inland Empire economy has definitely been bouncing forward. A little bit of a slowing over the course of the last year, however. As you know, of course, globally, there's been another sort of worldwide slowdown in growth. China's having issues. Europe, of course, is in the midst of a recession. And that has really slowed down the logistics industry and trade in general. And that's definitely taking a bit of a toll on the Inland Empire from a job perspective. However, there's lots of other signs that the area is doing much, much better. The real estate market is really on fire at this point in time. Construction is starting to return. Population growth is back. Consumer spending is up. And, boy, only thing you have to do is get on one of those highways to know that there's plenty of economic activity going on, eh?
Well, I know that at least the road construction industry seems to be doing well.
Absolutely. Yep. And, you know, we've been doing this for a couple of years now with UC Riverside, the event out there. And for us, it's always a great time to get out there and meet folks. You know, when we do these events, it's, you know, part of it is to bring people the sort of latest and the greatest from news and outlook and what's happening. But at the same time, the ability for us to sort of interact with the audience and hear what people are talking about, what's concerning them is just as valuable, candidly. You have to look at from 30,000 feet, but it's also here good to hear what's going on at the ground level.
Well, you know, people also react on anticipation of what's next, too. And so that has to do with hiring and aggressiveness. So it's good to get a kind of a check on where we're going, because a lot of people make decisions based on that. That's October 29th, and it's at the Riverside San Bernardino Auditorium and Event Center.
Yes.
And if you go to your website, BeaconEcon, BeaconEcon.com, you can get the information there. And I'll be in the audience looking forward to it.
And we look forward to having you, Bruce.
So how's our economy in general as far as the United States? And then based on that answer, I want to know what you think the policies of the Fed will probably end up being.
Mm. Well, I think our economy is getting a little bit better, but it's been getting a little bit better for the last few years. You know, it's funny. When you take a step back and look at our economy over the last 4 years, we're in the midst of what you would call kind of a mediocre expansion. I know it doesn't feel like that. I mean, everybody keeps talking about double dips and you know, complaining about how terrible things are. But you look at the numbers. Over the last 4 years, we've grown a little over 2% per year. Unemployment continues to fall a little less than a percentage point a year. we're adding a couple million jobs a year. And yes, by the way, most of those are full-time jobs. All this nonsense about all these being part-time jobs is just that, total nonsense. And so you say, well, you know, we're moving forward not as fast as we might like, but the economy is expanding, and people are, on average, better off. And, you know, ultimately, that's what it's about. Obviously, we'd all like to see more growth, but I think under the circumstances, where we are today is about the best we could expect, given the kind of crazy political climate in Washington, D.C. today, problems in the global economy overall, and the residual of what happened back in 08 and 09. Still having an influence on things. As for the Fed itself, well, you know, obviously Ben Bernanke has been making noise about the so-called end of quantitative easing.
Right.
And, you know, it's funny because this has really got a lot of people up in arms, but and a lot of people are nervous and wondering what it all means. But two things to keep in mind. We knew quantitative easing was going to come to an end, right?
Right.
I mean, it couldn't have possibly go on forever. And B, I think that everybody needs to take a step back and recognize that the sort of low interest rate environment we are in today is not just a function of quantitative easing. That's a mistake to think that. And yet people continue to believe that somehow or other the Fed really has this sort of huge influence on these long-term rates, and that's just not the case.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, when you think about quantitative easing 1, 2, and 3, you know, altogether they've pumped about $2 trillion into the economy so far, of which over $1.8 trillion is sitting in the banks in the form of excess reserves. 83% of all that cash has gone nowhere. It's just an accounting transaction between bank reserves and the Federal Reserve balance sheet. That's all it is. It's not real money. And if you look at what money has gotten out, what it's done is it's pushed the monetary base from a long-term 6% annual growth rate to about an 8% growth rate, which about is what you need in this current environment. So, you know, from that perspective, I think that people have really, they're overestimating the impact on long-term rates and on the way down, and I think that they're probably overestimating the impact when they get rid of quantitative easing, in terms of how much up it's going to go as well. Now, we know rates have been rising. They've been rising, you know, since the end of last year. It wasn't since Ben Bernanke made his comments in June. It's been going on for a while now, and a lot of that has to do with simply the diminishment of fear. You know, for a while, their rates were very, very low, but that's because everybody was afraid to put money in anything but treasuries.
Right.
But now that the economy has a little bit of life and some decent things are happening here and there, you're starting to see a little bit more investment activity, just a little bit more. From a long-term standpoint, I think you could argue that, you know, the housing market's still quite depressed. Overall business spending is still pretty light relative to the cash flow. But it is getting better, and what that means is people are walking away from these low-return but safe bonds and putting their money in other places inside the economy, and that is causing rates to drift up. But I would argue that's rates drifting up for a good reason. That is to say there are options, and people are making choices to put their money in something other than, you know, funding our massive budget deficit.
You know, the U.S. unemployment rate has gradually gotten lower, but the participation rate has gotten lower, too. Is that where most of the improvement is?
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
Most of the improvement is people getting jobs. And indeed, if you look at the decline in participation rates, there's no doubt about it. It's low. It's dropped to levels we haven't seen since the early 80s. But that sort of group of folks that have left the labor force can be divided into what I would call four groups. The first group are people who've gone back to school, and ultimately that's a good thing because we know that, you know, you get an education, it's a great investment in your future. There's another group of folks who wouldn't be in the labor force regardless. As you know, of course, boomers are getting into that 55 to 65-year-old range, starting to line up for retirement. The leading edge is just past the sort of retirement edge of retirement, 65 years old. Keep in mind that participation rates just automatically drop for people over 55. And as a result, the boomers all by themselves, just a long-term demographic impact of those moving into those years means the participation is going to drop.
Okay.
Of this other half of the decline in participation, I'm going to say these are truly discouraged workers. And I'm going to divide those into two camps. The first camp are people who are discouraged but will eventually be retrained, find a new job, they will get back into the workforce. And the other part are folks who candidly are not going to be back in the workforce anytime in the near future, maybe not ever. These are folks who you know, have been left behind. We live in a new kind of world now. Having skills is incredibly important. We know that more than ever. The creative fields are booming, where the kind of those low skilled jobs just, you know, that used to give a decent wage just don't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And this is reflected in our economy, of course, in part by that huge increase we've seen in, say, the number of people who are on Social Security disability rolls. They're not really disabled. They're just really incapable of finding what I would call reasonable employment in the context of our economy today, given their particular skill set. You know, keep in mind, if you're on Social Security disability, what are you making, $12,000 a year? These people are not, these aren't Cadillac Queens. These are people who are, you know, barely making ends meet with this public assistance. I call this a social crisis, not an economic crisis.
Okay.
And what I mean by that are these are people we have to worry about socially. But from an economic perspective, whether or not they go back to work is probably not all that important for where the economy heads over the course of the next decade.
Okay. Last year, real estate's you know, year over year up about 30%. What do you attribute that to, and do you think that's the direction of the future as well?
Well, when you say 30%, of course, you mean here in California.
Yeah, I'm talking about California.
Yeah, don't forget that on the nation overall, the prices are only up about 10-12%, so much less so. California really is on the leading edge of that. And that's a function of three things. I'm big in the list today. I don't know if you noticed that.
I did. I'm writing, as you say, I'm writing them down.
So, yeah, 30% year on year. Part of that's imaginary. Right. And what I mean is, while we say prices in the state are up 30%, that doesn't mean the value of your house is up 30%. Rather, prices look like they're up 30% because of the change in the mix.
Correct.
You know, a year ago and 2 years ago, there were many, many more distressed transactions in the state of California, foreclosure, short sales, units that typically sell for a degree of a discount. By our estimates, at one point in time, a foreclosure sale, for example, would be at a price about 25% below the market value of that house was, if it was not a distressed transaction. Why the low price? Probably the quality of the property was severely diminished. There might be various issues with titles, all sorts of reasons why foreclosures and short sales tend to sell at a discount. Well, the share of distressed transactions in that market mix, if you will, has gone down massively from maybe half a couple of years ago to like 15% today.
Correct.
And so that's certainly pushing the perceived or the market average price up, and that's just because there's fewer of those discounted units. But then there's two other considerations which are very real. A, as remember, California has one of the tightest housing markets out there. The U.S. overall right now, about 5 months supply, according to the National Association of Realtors. Of course, we talk about supply being the pace of sales divided by the number of units being listed. So we say 4.5 months. That means basically there's 4 months worth of sales currently listed in the market. Here in California, it's 2.5 months.
Right.
It's very, very tight. Part of that, of course, is because you know, there's still a lot of people who are underwater, for example, who can't transact. But even more significantly is the fact that the state hasn't built enough housing for the last two decades to meet its population growth needs. We have, even in the midst of the crisis, even with prices plummeting back in 2009 and 2010, we still had the lowest housing vacancy rate in the nation. Astonishing when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that sort of tightness will drive prices up, as simple as that.
I'm sure a builder would have built something if he could have sold it for a profit, though.
Mm. I disagree with that.
Okay.
If they can build it, they will make a profit. The problem here is not that they won't make a profit. The problem here is that they're not allowed to build it. Look how long it takes to get anything permitted in the state, courtesy, of course, CEQA. You know, you have any kind of designs on building, whether it's a new development out in the high desert or some sort of infill apartment complex, condo complex in the city, and it can take years and years and years of fighting off frivolous lawsuits all under the name of CEQA. I mean, look what's happening right now with the Millennium Project in Hollywood. Of course, it's going to be a huge project, hundreds and hundreds of units, desperately needed units, and all these folks are just fighting tooth and nail against it. They're coming up with any kind of excuse to try and shrink that or prevent it from being built. And what you have, of course, is just the extreme of NIMBYism. You have these people complaining, well, I don't want that in my neighborhood. That's density. It's getting crowded here. Well, this is L.A., folks. This is the second largest city in the nation. This is a densely populated area. If you don't want to live in a densely populated area, move. It's you know, it's not your world. We have to share. People want to be in California. They're going to come here one way or the other. And there's two ways of accommodating that. One way, of course, is to build on the periphery, keep putting sprawl out there, or make these highways bigger and longer and wider as we get worse and worse traffic and air pollution. Or we can do the second, more reasonable thing, which is to really continue the process of densification, continue to build the kind of public transport systems that work in the context of a dense economy, and you know, it grow up, if you will, become a modern city.
Well, you mentioned construction. It's usually a bigger piece of the pie than it is right now.
Absolutely, and that, of course, is true in the nation overall, and here in California in particular. If you look at, for example, housing starts, particularly for, say, single family, they're not even running 600,000 units annually right now, which is half the long-term kind of long average rate. Very depressed still, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that we really haven't seen a return to home ownership. The tight housing markets we're seeing here in the state and in the nation overall is not so much due to a broad-based increase in demand for owner-occupied properties. Rather, it has to do with the fact that there's definitely some demand for it, but at the same time, we're also seeing a very large increase, of course, in demand for properties by investors.
Right.
About 3-4 million, by our estimates, or 4 million more single-family rental units in the market today than 3 years ago, which is a big, big number. And it makes total sense. You know, it's funny because people are like, why are prices rising so much? Well, a lot of it has to do with the fact that over the last few years, and I've said this on your show before, Bruce, prices have been ridiculously affordable. When you look at incomes, you look at those interest rates, housing hasn't been this cheap in decades in the U.S. overall. And even here in California, it's been relatively cheap relative to the last few decades. And with that in mind, much of the price increase you're seeing now is really the housing market bouncing back towards something resembling normalcy. You know, even at interest rates at, say, 4.5% where they are now, national prices would have to go up another 20%. Before you got back to what we call normal levels of affordability,
mm-hmm.
given incomes today. And that, of course, doesn't account for the fact that incomes are also starting to grow a little faster. So with that in mind, these price increases are really in a market that's just kind of going back to a normal place, but in many other levels, for example, like you said, construction is still very depressed because home ownership rates continue to fall. As we know, that the mortgage markets are not acting appropriately. It's very hard to get mortgages in today's economy. The Fannie and Freddie, for example, the average loan they're making today is a FICO score of like 750. Compare that to 710 a decade ago.
FHA might even be worse as far as who they used to loan to and who they're loaning to now. Bigger spread. I mean, they used to loan to under 660. It was 60% of their business. Now it's something like 9%.
Yeah, exactly. So it's everything's much, much tighter out there. And we know refi activity, while it was doing pretty well for a while, is really slowed down quite a bit. There's almost zero equity extraction in today's market. It's very difficult to get a HELOC loan. So, you know, I have heard people make comments that, you know, it's starting to smell like a bubble, and I just laugh because it's nothing of the sort. In fact, you could argue that as opposed to going into a new bubble, really these prices are reflecting what I would call leading edge of the housing recovery.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the affordability numbers for California, we're at 36 after the rate hike and after the price increase, and the highest we ever got in the 90s, like 96, was 40%.
Right.
So we haven't used up too much of our affordability, and that really gives you some sustainability going forward.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
How's migration for California? Is all of our growth still coming from immigration?
Yeah, we're still seeing domestic out-migration, there's no doubt about it. But again, you know, it's funny how there's two ways of interpreting that. One way is the kind of, you know, shrieking hysterics of the right way of looking at things, which is to say that all the millionaires in the state of California are leaving because of our high tax rates, and our economy is going to collapse as a result of the loss of these folks. And in reality, if you sit down and look at the numbers, it's not rich folks. People make a decision of where they live on a consumption basis, not an investment basis. You know, people want to live in California because they want to live in California.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're wealthy, you're willing to pay for that. Just like if you're wealthy, you're willing to pay for a fancy car or you're willing to pay for a fancy boat. You're also willing to pay for a fancy house in California despite the higher tax and everything else because you want to be here. The people who leave the state are actually what I would call kind of the backbone of the modern economy. It's the mid-skilled folks. People would say a two-year technical degree. These are people who would say under normal circumstances make $50,000, $60,000 a year, which means pretty much anywhere else in the U.S. they can go out and get a nice house, but not here, not with our system, not with our lack of housing and our incredibly high prices. And they're the ones who are indeed leaving at this particular point in time. Mm-hmm. Did you hear the editorial comment from
yes.
my cat back there?
Yes, I have some of those.
He's getting ready to leave as well.
You know, we've had this environment of ridiculously low interest rates, and that's been great if you're a borrower. But if you have money and trying to chase yield, including, you know, like retirement programs, it's been a tough time.
Well, yes, but get used to it. Simple as that. Because, again, those long-term rates are low, not because of the Fed, not because of government policy, but because of the fact that we live in a world which has lots and lots of capital available. Look, the Asian economies are growing. They're savers. They're putting billions of dollars into the capital markets every single year. At the same time, a slow-growing U.S., a recessionary Europe means there's not a lot of demand for capital. Throw into the mix information technology, which means you get a lot more investment bang for your buck if you happen to be a business. And you add that all up, and what it says to me is that rates are here with us to stay for a while.
Well, if that's true, how are we doing? How are we going to? You know, we have retirement programs projecting what 7.5% and 8% returns in an environment that's very unlikely to occur.
You got that right. That's a big problem. We have to stop pretending that these funds are solid, and when they're not, we have to start, you know, telling our pension funds that they need to be more honest about what their needs are from a financial standpoint. But of course, if you did that, the political price would be horrendous, because it would mean that the contributions of all sorts of cities and states would just go through the roof in order to backfill all those losses.
Well, or what's the alternative? Is Detroit going to set a precedent that backfills into some legal problems for other areas?
Well, legal problems or legal solutions?
Well,
I mean, look,
like
you're right. The other way of dealing with this, of course, is to start cutting benefits. But as you know, over the years, many states under the sort of, I don't know what, have built into their constitutions these guarantees that say that while the rest of us out in the world may see losses in our 401k or may see our pension get cut somehow or other, public unions are sacrosanct and cannot be touched.
Right.
And that, of course, goes back to the Detroit situation. By the way, it's not just Detroit. There's three cases out there today which are going to end up setting some precedent. One is Detroit. Two, of course, is San Bernardino. And three is Stockton. In all three cases, the question becomes one of, does federal bankruptcy code trump pensions? Does that federal bankruptcy code trump these kind of local protections for pensions?
Right.
The answer is probably yes. I mean, we have seen a lot of precedent in many different parts of sort of legal discussions in the U.S. in which absolutely federal law takes precedent, and these kind of local conditions aren't I'm not sure the legal term, superseding, I guess would be the right way of saying it.
Right. Christopher, you know what? We've run out of time. And
Already?
Already, yeah. This always goes fast. We're going to really enjoy having you on our I Survive Real Estate panel October 18th.
Oh, absolutely,
and
yeah.
And we've got really the most exciting group I think we've ever had. Sean O'Toole will be back to spar around with you. So looking forward to that night very much, and thanks for joining us.
Always good to be here.
Okay, thanks.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate, Adrenaline Athletics, California Property Solvers, Coldwell Banker Town & Country, Claudia Buys Houses, Elite Auctions, Phoebe, For Investors, Buy Investors, In a Day Development, Inland Empire Investors Forum, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Investor Experts, Inc., Keystone CPA, Las Brisas Escrow, Lavis Associates, Mike Cantu, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, Northern San Diego Real Estate Investors Association, Orange County Real Estate Investors Association, Orange County Investment Club Phoebe, Personal Real Estate Magazine, Pilot Limo, Primary Residential Mortgage, Realty 411 Magazine, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Southwest Riverside County Association of Realtors, Sunoco Corporation, Spinnaker Loans, UDirect IRA, Tony Alvarez, Westin South Coast Plaza, ICISurvivedRealEstate.com for more on the event and all of our sponsors.